Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Top military officials say the 2017 continuing resolution could be the worst yet. The service chiefs of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and Marine Corps all told Congress this week this could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Federal News Radio Scott Mossioni joins me with more. And I guess we don't know yet, Scott, whether the CR will go to the end of the year. Despite what I hear from the Senate, it seems to be likely that it will.
Yeah, it's they have until April 28th to actually pass a continuing resolution. So it's still going to be a while before we know if there's going to be a year-long one or they're actually going to get this budget hammered down.
So why do the service chiefs say, why did they tell this panel the other day on the Hill that 2017 is somehow worse than previous years?
Right. We'll know. The services are no stranger to continuing resolutions. They've had to deal with these in 2010 all the way up until now in 2017. I think there may have been 1 year in between that they didn't actually have a continuing resolution. But what General Milley, who's the chief of staff of the Army, likened this to is smoking. He said, you have one cigarette, it's not going to kill you, it's not good for you. But if you do it over 20 years or 8 years in this case, that's really going to start hurting the readiness of the force. And I think that's really what he was concerned about. And, just over time, you take out these little chunks of the military and it finally adds up to something big.
Were they able to offer specifics about what could happen if the CR goes all year and they go into 2017 with the same level of funding they had in 2016?
They were. Well, the military, they were expecting a little bit of a bump in 2017. So they have budgeted for, the past 8 months or so for what they expected to have in 2017. So now that's going to run out. The Army especially is saying that they're not going to be able to train their military, basically. So no more boot camp starting in July. They can't take in more recruits. The Navy would have to stop aviation, flying hours, things like that. Same with the Air Force. And they also wouldn't be able to do maintenance. So, a lot of these bases, one in five bases really, are in detrimental shape right now. So instead of having to do regular maintenance and making sure everything's okay, they're going to have to wait until something breaks and then fix it, which ends up being more expensive in the long run.
And it slows them down. You report the Marine Corps would cancel flight operations for 24 squadrons.
Yeah.
And so there goes their readiness. And you're reporting that the Air Force would defer about 2,000 new recruiting actions until 2018. Of course, if 2018 is the same as 2017, then maybe they would keep deferring them.
And one thing that Congress asked them is this the new norm? Should the military just prepare for a continuing resolution every year? And what General Milley, the chief of staff of the Army, what he said was that would be basically malpractice on congressional standards.
Interesting. So they really sort of gave it to Congress in a tough way.
Yeah, at least in that sense. But you still have to remember that the Defense Department isn't audited. So we don't really know how much of this money they really need. They have $603 billion budgeted by Donald Trump for next year. Right now, they're working with about $570 billion. And then you add in OCO, it gets up to, $617 billion about.
We're speaking with Federal News Radio Scott Mossioni. And of course, service chiefs always want to overstate. There's always sandbagging going on by both sides here in these budget debates, but do you get the sense that this is more than just sandbagging, that they are really serious about what they might not have?
I think that they're serious about what they might not have in this year, but we always have to remember that the Defense Department, like I was saying, is not audited. About a year ago, a report came out saying that the Defense Department could save $125 billion over the next 5 years without firing anyone. That's purely through just streamlining IT and making better contracts. So the Defense Department is a huge, bloated, and wasteful department. Without that auditing, without being careful and knowing what they're doing with their money, it seems like, they just get the money that they need and they can just go ahead and say, Congress will always give us the money that we need. So it's important that they stop and maybe think a little bit more about what they're going to do with the money that they spend. And continuing resolution may be able to do that.
So the debate goes on and on. I guess this goes back to the Eisenhower administration,
sure.
These kinds of
debates. The military-industrial complex.
You also visited the Defense Innovation Board meeting, and what's going on there? Because innovation is one way they could get around their cost base that they have now.
Right. Well, the Defense Innovation Board, if you remember, was started by Ash Carter, the former defense secretary, and it's filled with all these Silicon Valley bigwigs. Eric Schmidt of Google, he's the executive chairman of Alphabet, which is Google's parent company. There's Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the famous astrophysicist, basically the Carl Sagan of our day. These guys got together and they gave a bunch of recommendations to DoD back in January, which they've already done some work on. But their newest one is creating, or they're thinking about this recommendation, creating a repository for all of DoD's information, which is a big, huge undertaking if you think about the amount of data that DoD takes in each day.
And I'm sure Google would like to host it for $1 million a week.
Oh, I'm sure they would, yes.
Sorry, Eric, but yeah, you got to ask that question. So what is the reaction of the military to that?
They would love something like that, but to actually implement something like that is almost impossible at this point, at least. You know, the Silicon Valley guys say that's not impossible because nothing's impossible for them. But to take all of the legacy systems and make sure that they're compatible with the repository, to collect all that data, get it together and put it somewhere, the cybersecurity of that one area. And then Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, he actually said, you know, what if this is a Library of Alexandria moment where we put all this data in one repository and then something happens to it and we lose everything?
It burns.
Right, exactly. So, you know, you have to think about backing up something that huge. And just to put in perspective how much data DoD takes in, the Air Force, just their intelligence side, each day takes in 22 terabytes of information. That's five seasons of NFL games all in one, just the video.
Well, the answer to all this is not to build some giant data warehouse or data lake, depending on the technology you like. It's really to, I think, be able to access the data you need wherever it might be using the right tools and have a virtual large data pack, but not right. Everything is literally going to be in one big giant repository. I don't think that would be possible or desirable.
Right. And, you know, they're in that recommendation phase right now where they're trying to figure out what exactly this repository would mean. And that's kind of the whole point of the Innovation Board, is that they come up with the big ideas and then DoD has to actually figure out what to do with it.
Well, maybe some of those billionaires could kick in a few bucks and help out.
That would help.
Federal News Radio, Scott Massioni, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Check out his coverage at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
This is Scott Massioni. Follow me for the latest news critical to the defense community on Twitter at @SMassioniWFED. SMAUCIONEWFED.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, WFED.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The latest disclosure to WikiLeaks about the intelligence community's technical capabilities highlights a simple fact. The government doesn't always disclose the cybersecurity vulnerabilities it finds in commercial software. The IC is not shy about it. Officials say they need to leave some security holes open so they can use them to spy on foreign adversaries. That position puts the IC at odds with the U.S. software industry. Daniel Castro is vice president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. He talked with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu about why he thinks the government needs to adopt a, quote, responsible disclosure policy in line with what private sector security researchers have done.
The purpose of a responsible disclosure policy is to get information out as quickly as possible to minimize risk. And so what that generally means is that when a vulnerability is discovered in software, it's communicated accurately and quickly to the developers, who can then go and patch the system before the vulnerability is widely known and exploits can be developed. It also means, though, if a developer does not choose to take action after a reasonable amount of time, that they know that whoever discloses vulnerability will then go and make that vulnerability public. That way, any users of any affected hardware or software can take any steps they think are necessary to minimize the risk of running these running any technology with vulnerabilities on it.
So the government says that it has an overwhelming bias in favor of disclosing vulnerabilities when it runs across them, and in fact the NSA says it does disclose 91% of what it finds so that vendors can, as you said, fix the problems. But you know, they say there are some that they need to hold on to because they're providing intelligence value at the moment. You know, they're currently being exploited by the agency to collect on a foreign adversary, et cetera. So, softball question, why is 91% not good enough in your view?
Yeah, well, there's two problems with that 91% number. First of all, that number doesn't really tell you how long they hold on to a vulnerability. So if they hold on to something for, a week or a year or 2 years or 3 years, and then eventually disclose it, that still counts as in that 91%. So that number by itself isn't a very good metric. The second problem with that number is, you know, the NSA, for all, its capabilities, doesn't have the ability to know which vulnerabilities are ones that have not been discovered by somebody else. And that's really the central issue here. If the 9% are vulnerabilities that Russia or China or some other just for-profit hacker has discovered, that's putting Americans at risk, and unnecessarily. And so the reason to bring that 91% number as close to 100 as possible is because we simply don't know what's in that 9% and how much impact that can have. And to give a very specific example of this, the NSA reportedly allowed a major security flaw, which was known as Heartbleed, to exist for years, specifically because they were able to exploit it for surveillance purposes. But when a Google engineer discovered this vulnerability in 2014, this was a vulnerability that was affecting 2/3 of the world's websites. So the risk of, risk of keeping these vulnerabilities undisclosed can have tremendous impact.
Given that lag time, is there maybe a middle ground here? I mean, could you set up a framework where, let's say the NSA has an ongoing operation where it's actively collecting against a foreign target, but it goes ahead and discloses the vulnerability to the software maker so that they can at least start the process of developing a patch, developing a fix, and then releasing that fix as soon as the NSA's, ongoing collection is over? Would that partially satisfy some of the concerns that you have?
It would. I mean, even today, if, the NSA discloses a vulnerability, it's not going to be patched overnight,
right,
and they can still exploit it. More than that, even if a system is, patchable, it doesn't mean it actually will be patched in practice. And so, just because a vulnerability has been disclosed to a vendor, it doesn't mean that, the target of any surveillance will necessarily receive that update. But, at the end of the day, this gets to, one of those fundamental problems that we have in our U.S. Cyber policy, which is that we're putting our ability to penetrate our adversaries' networks ahead of our ability to defend our own. And, when we prioritize things in that way, we're always going to be coming down the side of, let's let Americans be insecure instead of focusing on security and trying to get intelligence through other means.
If we do go in that direction, though, and fully make that trade-off in favor of security, cybersecurity in favor of, the ability to penetrate foreign systems, 100% disclosure, that almost begs the question of why even bother to have a foreign intelligence service that's focused on intel collection through cyber in the first place if you're going to force them to shut down their entry points into those foreign systems every time they find one. Because I think we can say with a pretty high degree of certainty that China and Russia are not going to play by those same rules.
Well, I mean, I think there's a few things there. I mean, first of all, the U.S. will be more secure if our systems are being patched. And if the NSA is and other intelligence agencies are putting dedicated resources behind finding vulnerabilities and helping making Americans more secure that way. So, there's a, there is maybe loss on one side of the equation, but there's also gain on the other. And so I think we need to consider that balance. But second, there is, of course, the issue of implementation. There's, what we want to see is we want to see the U.S. government doing everything they can to make American businesses and citizens secure. That means, getting them access to secure software, and that means possibly, helping them even if they have issues themselves with implementation. But, you know, I'm not suggesting the NSA go out and help ISIS secure its networks. So, you know, when they don't have that expertise, they're still going to be making mistakes. There are still ways to exploit vulnerabilities in terms of implementation. And of course, there's other types of intelligence gathering activities that will continue to go on that also will yield results.
That's Daniel Castro, Vice President of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, speaking with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu. We'll post a link to Castro's blog post about responsible disclosure and this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
This is Jared Serbu. I'm tweeting daily about the news that's interesting and important to the armed services and the defense contractors who serve them. Follow me at jserbu, WFED.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Navy is asking Congress to change military personnel laws to let the service grant early merit-based promotions to officers. As Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu reports, the Navy wants to take a more surgical approach to promotions rather than advancing its officers based on rigid schedules.
Navy and other defense officials tried but failed to persuade Congress to make the change as part of the 2017 defense authorization bill that passed in December. But top Navy personnel officials are lobbying lawmakers to include the language in this year's bill. It would allow military promotion boards to place officers of particular merit at the top of promotion lists ahead of their peers. Currently, seniority, according to an officer's lineal number, is the main factor that determines when he or she will move to the next rank. The current promotion system was set in place by the 1981 Defense Officer Personnel Management Act. And Vice Admiral Robert Burke, the Chief of Naval Personnel, says the proposal is one of several changes the Navy wants to make in order to make the system more flexible.
We're still thinking through, you know, what is it that we would like the end state of a new, you know, what do we want the to-be state to look like for a revised officer system? And all the services are sort of thinking through this. We're going to continue to learn and explore this and maybe put together a more consolidated group of proposals for how we might reshape the officer promotion packages. But in general, what we want to do is have a little more flexibility from DOTMA to promote more people sooner. In order to do that, though, you have to have more flexibility to ask people to go home sooner as well. And we don't have that in DOTMA right now for officers like you do on the enlisted side. So we need that tool as well, and we're looking at how we do that fairly and in a measured manner. We have tools to do these, you know, giant, whacking jobs that are not very precise at all, and they're very ugly, and we don't want to use those tools.
Both former Navy Secretary Ray Mabus and former Defense Secretary Ash Carter pushed for more flexible military career paths as part of a wide-ranging personnel reform initiative called Force of the Future. But Congress rejected the officer promotion change precisely because lawmakers viewed it as a piecemeal approach, saying that DOD never submitted a broader legislative package that would have implemented personnel reforms in a comprehensive way. In a report last month, the Bipartisan Policy Center endorsed the idea of merit-based officer promotions, along with several other changes, including a replacement of the military's up-or-out promotion system with one that lets officers stay in their current ranks as long as they continue to perform well. But the panel cautioned that DOD would need to make wider changes in order to make a new promotion system work, including overhauling its performance rating system to make sure the military services understand who their best performers truly are. Rear Admiral Richard Brown, the commander of Navy Personnel Command, says the Navy fully recognizes its evaluation system is in dire need of modernization, including by building in new capabilities to measure skills and education rather than just performance.
Our current FITREP eval process, which uses RISCAs and traits and rankings, etc., was conceived, developed, and executed by a small group of people under a CNO BORDA in just under 15 months in 1996. And so that system has been in place for over 21 years. It's time to refine our requirements and get an updated system that supports our mission and our requirements, but also supports the folks that are working for us and helps us to better identify the talent and manage that talent. Some of the aspirational things that we're looking at is developing a system where we rate to a standard vice small competitive peer groupings. Performance evaluations that are tailored to pay bands. Does it make sense that an ensign's fit rep looks exactly like a captain's fit rep? Or an E1's evaluation looks exactly like an E6's evaluation? We are targeting and formalizing counseling as a foundation of the performance evaluation and providing timely, objective, and written and graded feedback to our officers and our sailors.
But Rear Admiral John Nowell, the Director of Military Personnel Plans and Policy, says the Navy has already shown that merit-based promotion can work within the uniformed services. Starting in 2015, the Navy implemented the Meritorious Advancement Program within its enlisted force, which lets commanding officers, executive officers, and command master chiefs select their best and brightest sailors for accelerated promotion.
So we still do Navy-wide advancement exams. We still have, you know, the spring and the fall cycle. But we wanted to empower those triads to be able to, you know, pluck those front runners and go ahead and move them up faster. And so we started in 2015. It was about 5% of the advancements for the year. We have, you know, opened it up. We started with it being sea-centric. We went sea to shore. We then opened it up to more commands there. We broadened it. We relaxed some of the rules with respect to the timing aspect and eligibility. And so we're at 10% of the advancement for 2017 will be done via MAP. Of those, about 20% of the E6s that will be advanced via MAP.
And Burke, the Naval Personnel Chief, says he remains hopeful that Congress will approve a similar system for officers in the upcoming legislative cycle.
So again, Senate's on board with that. In fact, we just had the Senate staffers over yesterday. They reiterated their general support for the idea. We got to go back and re-engage. So lots of work to do, probably a couple years before we're going to see some legislative change on that, but we continue to push.
In the shorter term, Burke says Congress's inaction on passing a budget has broad implications for the military personnel system. Leaving a continuing resolution in place for the rest of the year, he says, would have serious impacts.
The biggest accounts that have financial accounts in the manpower world that have any fungibility to them. They're sort of the money surge tanks for the Navy, and the ones that get impacted the biggest anytime there's cash flow issues, which is what a continuing resolution does to all of the services. It's permanent change of station money, so money to do moves, and it's money to pay bonuses. And to answer the specifics of how badly we would be impacted by a CR depends on exactly how the CR gets written. At this point, there's a lot of debate going on the Hill as to what the reference point for a continuing resolution would be. Normally, it's the last year's budget. And if they write it according to what FY16's budget baseline would be, I will be, in dire straits. We will be, you know, stopping, most moves sometime in June. We will be stopping bonuses going forward, you know, sometime in June. It will be fairly catastrophic, and we've told lawmakers that.
In Washington, Jared Serbu, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.
Check out all of Jared's DoD coverage at FederalNewsRadio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at FederalNewsRadio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.